Wednesday, June 21st, 2017, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, rumors. We're going to talk about a bunch of rumors, like the ones people were reporting following allegations of a sexual assault on the set of The Bachelor in Paradise, and how some outlets covered it and others didn't, and how that story has since played out and production beginning again. Then there are the other rumors, the ones that are floating around that White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer is vetting candidates to replace him so that he can assume a higher role in the administration, at the same time a CNN reporter goes on a rant pretty much calling him useless. And we'll talk about some facts too, like the Cosby mistrial, contracts benching employees, and Fox dropping its iconic fair and balanced motto. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but let's start with something we talked about last week, an update, if you will, Megyn Kelly's big segment with InfoWars founder Alex Jones. The network caught a lot of heat for doing that interview, so much so that there was talk of an 11th hour edit amid calls to pull the piece entirely. In fact, the NBC-owned station in Hartford, Connecticut, chose not to run the program to save the Newtown community the heartache of seeing it on their TVs. So what happened? Well, here's how Kelly tossed to the piece.
Some thought we shouldn't broadcast this interview because his baseless allegations aren't just offensive. They're dangerous. But here's the thing. Alex Jones isn't going away. Over the years, his YouTube channel has racked up 1.3 billion views. He has millions of listeners and the ear of our current president.
It's a justification for running the piece, one that I'll ask Mike and Ernest whether they agree with in a second. But before I do, I want to play this clip as Kelly walks through the InfoWars workspace.
The InfoWars staffers we met have free rein to cover whatever they like with virtually no oversight. We spoke with some of Jones's employees, including Owen Schroyer.
How do you, on a day-to-day basis, figure out what you're going to do?
I wake up, I look at the news, I pray. I rarely get directives from Alex or my boss. They pretty much just leave it up to me.
Is that what you consider yourself to be, a journalist?
You know, I don't like calling it that. I'm just a human. I'm just a human that's looking for truth. So I'm trying to reach out and be what the people want.
When you say people, who do you mean?
The deplorables, the flyover country, the forgotten American.
Well, we're in flyover country here. I don't know that we're all the deplorables. After all of the hype, after watching the 17 and a half minute piece, your thoughts, your reactions?
Well, first of all, I'd say all of this sort of preemptive shaming of Megyn Kelly and the pushing by people not to air this, just watch the interview. Mm-hmm. If you watch the interview, I think you'd come away saying, She laid him out. I mean, she gave him an opportunity to say some really stupid things, and he did. And when he tried to prevaricate, when he tried to misdirect, she called him on it. So it seemed to me like the interview was a pretty darn good one.
Yeah, I looked at the interview. I thought it was a good interview. I thought that she asked all the tough questions. She challenged him on a lot of the sort of baseless and in some cases useless things that are on his site and that he puts on the airwaves. I thought she did a good job with that. What bothered me about all of this mm-hmm. was this sort of push to silence him. I mean, he's been out there. It's not like he's going to go away. He's been on the fringes, and some would say he's still on the fringes. And I do think that she does make a very good point, is that he's not going away. People need to know about this. He does have the ear of the president, and someone needs to challenge him. And she did that. And I think part of this goes back to the fact that there are going to be some people who are not going to forgive Megyn Kelly, especially those on the left, because she worked at Fox. And I think some of that is what's coming up in this as well.
So one of the things we talked about last week in previewing this was, why trot out an interview like this so early in the tenure of this new show on NBC? And one of the things that Jamie Navalga had mentioned was that it was really an attempt to create buzz, to attract an audience, to bring people to the show. Ratings aren't proving that happened.
You know, first of all, it's launching in the summertime. It's running up against 60 Minutes. Has anybody ever successfully competed against that? I don't know. But I'll say this much. The people who are suggesting, oh, we should wait. There was one piece, I think, on our Links blog suggesting, oh, we should give her time to develop as a network interviewer, give her time to prove herself. Just sounds sexist to me. If you have a new show, you are going to want to go with the best, most controversial content you possibly can come up with. Maybe she didn't do such a great job interviewing Putin, although I'm not sure who could. But I would put this in there early if I were NBC.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with them running this so early in her tenure.
Yeah.
I agree with Mike. I do think that, you know, there are people out there who are criticizing her, and a lot of it is sexist. The issue to me is the fact that they are trying to run this against 60 Minutes. NBC has tried, ABC has tried, every network has tried to run something against 60 Minutes. It never works because they don't stick with it long enough.
Mm-hmm.
And 60 Minutes has been around for three, decades. Four, five yeah. decades. So it's going to be very hard to knock 60 Minutes off of that perch.
I thought it was really interesting that Alex Jones tried to knock her off before it even aired.
By running and releasing right. the phone call in the conversation. So let me ask you about that.
Yeah.
Was it a gotcha interview, or do you think Megyn Kelly stuck by her gotcha hit piece? Or did she stand by the promise of not making it the gotcha piece?
First of all,
yeah.
a promise to a very difficult to acquire interviewee that, oh, don't worry, it's not going to be a hit piece. It was a tough interview. And that's the way a lot of people, when you try to get some cretin like Alex Jones to agree to be interviewed, you'll say things up to a certain extent that would lure them into thinking, oh, it's all going
to
be
appeal
fine.
Appeal to their ego, if you will.
Appeal to his ego. He's been around the block a time or two. He had to know what was going on.
Yeah, he knew that she was going to ask him the tough questions. I mean, these are the controversial issues that he's built his reputation on. So, of course, she was going to challenge him on it. He had the opportunity to come back, and he did, but all he did was double down on a lot of the crazy things that he's been saying for years. And now it's sort of exposed to a larger audience, but I'm with Mike. I mean, you run this in July, you're not going to get a huge audience. If you'd have done this, say, in November, or even, say, in September, right after NFL football, now you're talking about
either
a large
is
audience.
A lead into football or after football.
Right, right, right.
When people are in the whole, you know, season premiere mode,
exactly,
as opposed
exactly.
to on Father's Day in June when people are barbecuing or they're out playing baseball or whatever they're doing.
Right. And the promotion generally on this, even just set aside the timing, seemed pretty lame on NBC's part. If they had an interview like this where they were going after this guy for good reason, why didn't they promote a tough interview was coming up on Alex Jones? Why kind of play the sort of half cutesy way that they promoted yeah. the interview? I wouldn't have done that. The other thing that kind of, you know, gets me is I understand the idea that interviews can be biased
mm-hmm.
or that the edit can be unflattering. It's perfectly okay for anybody to insist, I'm going to have my own recording of this interview. Sort of the preemptive way in which Alex Jones did this, I think just shame on him, but it's okay for somebody to say, I want to make sure that you don't edit me to make me look bad, because that can happen. And we don't know what the original aired version of that piece was going to be before all the outcry
came. That's right. Well, I've done a lot of reading about the segment, about the program, the editing, all of it. And you know what people aren't talking about? Tom Brokaw's 2.5-minute essay that appeared at the end of the broadcast in reaction to the piece. Here's a small bit of it.
I did two documentaries at the turn of the century called The Web of Hate, hoping to slow that trend. But the reach and the poisonous claims of Alex Jones and others like him, and even establishment public figures, would not be slowed. We cannot disrupt the irrational spread of hate and division by instantly blindly blaming the other side or by looking away. The parents of Newtown. It's not enough to say, I cannot imagine, because unless we're the parents, we can never, ever share the unremitting pain, the lifelong loss and anger, nor should they have to hear the cruel claim that it was a lie.
I wanted to bring this up because it doesn't seem to be getting a lot of attention in the discussion after the piece, and it kind of rubbed me the wrong way that I felt like NBC was kind of pandering a little bit to its critics by trotting out its well-respected old grandpa of the NBC News division to kind of say, it's okay, we hear you, and yeah, please don't be mad at us, we see it too.
Well, yeah, I think you could take it that way, but you know, when I looked at this, my thought on it was he is telling a message that I think needs to be told, not just by NBC but by other reputable news organizations out there, about the fact that these people need to be challenged. The Alex Joneses of the world need to be challenged on the claims that they're making, which is not based in fact. And you have people out there who are gravitated toward that, some because it fits into the narrative that they want to believe, but others because they just don't know enough of the information. Those are the ones that I'm concerned about. And this is where where news organizations need to challenge these narratives that aren't based on facts. So his message, I think, was right. Maybe he could have given that message in another context, in another program, and it might have resonated a little bit more.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I think that it was clearly done for damage control. Mm-hmm. I mean, as you say, the senior statesman, the guy that wrote about the greatest generation. I mean, all these reasons are why they trotted him out there. But what he said, basically, if you take the right after the part that you just excerpted, he said, we can't allow the agents of hate to go unchallenged, which is pretty much, in a more artful way, exactly what Megyn Kelly said in introducing her interview.
Right.
Well, Alex Jones became a household name in part because of Donald Trump, so it seems like a logical segue into our Trump administration. Or maybe it's not, but I'm going to try it anyway. Let's talk about those rumors that are flying around D.C. that Sean Spicer is vetting a new press secretary, someone who can replace him in the briefing room. These rumors started about the same time Jim Acosta went on the air and said this.
The White House press secretary is getting to a point, Brooke, where he's just kind of useless. You know, if he can't come out and answer the questions and they're just not going to do this on camera or audio, why are we even having these briefings or these gaggles in the first place?
Well, and so we've been talking about these problems for weeks. I even saw last night on CNN on Anderson Cooper that CNN is now keeping a running list of all of the questions that they have asked of Sean Spicer that he has not answered or dodged. Even if he does move up into a higher role, that's not necessarily going to change the value of these press briefings.
Well, the thing about it is the value of the press briefings were dying out anyway. Even back during Obama's administration, you can go back to George W. Bush. I mean, they were getting very little coverage. I mean, at one point, the only place you could find it was on C-SPAN. So that's not where you're going to get your news and information. To be honest, one of the only reasons that people were paying attention to Spicer and the afternoon gaggle, as they call it, was because it was Spicer and the things he was saying and the way in which he operated. That was the news, not what he was saying. So, you know, as a reporter, you're not going to get your information from there, so you shouldn't get upset that, you know, that it's headed in this direction. We all saw it coming when Trump came in the office.
You know, the piece from Jim Acosta, and I saw that live, and I thought to myself, you know, I know he believes that. I know he feels that way. I know Anderson Cooper, in doing this tally, believes that's important. I know that Jake Tapper, who is a longtime White House correspondent, thinks it's terrible the way that the press is being attacked, and we have a role to play. But after a while, it starts to look kind of like a set piece.
Yeah.
It's again, we're just focusing too much attention on us as journalists and not on the content. The briefings, you're right, that they're becoming less and less valuable. And frankly, I wonder who in the world would want this job, who would have any credibility doing that.
Well, there
job.
Have been a bunch of names thrown around, Laura Ingraham being among them, who said she doesn't want it. She keeps turning it down.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the thing about it is they're having a hard time filling real government jobs in the Trump administration, not just handling the press. I mean, we're talking about jobs that matter to the American people. He's having a problem
in terms of
people.
The running of government. In terms like, these of do matter government. On some yeah, level, yes. But not in terms. But the government isn't going to shut down if the press secretary is not there.
Exactly. Okay. But this is. I mean, that's what's going on right now. To me, that's the story. What's going on in terms of filling these appointments? I mean, we're almost 6 months in to his administration, and jobs that should have been filled months ago are still left out there because people don't want to take them.
And frankly, you know, I would just say no one is going to be an effective spokesperson for President Trump as long as President Trump is going to be his own spokesperson. He is. He's going on Twitter. He's going to say whatever he says. It's going to contradict as many times as not what his spokespeople are saying. So let's just do away with the middleman and acknowledge the fact that the president's going to be his own spokesman through the media that he wants to use.
Well, you know, Spicer said that the other day. He said, look, the president had two engagements today in which he spoke. Those are his words. Mm-hmm. Why do I need to come out here and talk? Well, just let him do it every day then, instead of you coming out here or someone else coming out here and having these sort of press conferences that don't really matter because Trump will contradict you at 2 in the morning in a tweet. There you go.
Well, we haven't had nearly the opportunity to discuss international free press issues as we'd like the past few months. And that's why when I saw this, I wanted to bring it up. There are reports out there that the Mexican government has been sending text messages to journalists and their family members that contain spyware. These messages have been very highly targeted. Who'd they go to? And what kind of malware was involved? What did it do?
They went to journalists, to human rights activists, to other people who are trying to fight against corruption in the Mexican government. And it's really insidious because the government apparently paid an Israeli company for access to the software, agreeing that they would only use it to fight terrorism and organized crime and drug trafficking. But they're sending it out to these folks who are opponents of the government. And the way they did it was through text messages, basically saying something to try to trick them into clicking on a link, which would then download this software onto their phone and not only send all their personal information back, we assume, to government servers, but allowing them to turn on or off the camera and the microphone of the phone to use that to surreptitiously record them. So that's going way too far.
Yeah, I would tell anyone who's really interested in the story, the New York Times and their stories on the Link with Blog really spells out what this is about. And it's, I mean, we're talking about it in the context of what the Mexican government is doing in going after activists and journalists and others who are criticizing them. But I was reading this story thinking about what other governments are using this, because the company that sells this software, the Israeli company that sells the software, will only sell it to the government and only under certain circumstances or certain promises are made about how they're going to use it. But there's nothing that's binding into that, and there's no way that the company or anyone else can go back and sort of take this off of someone's phone or keep the government from using it for nefarious reasons.
Well, that's one of the things that's a little troublesome about this. When President Enrique Peña Nieto came to power in 2012, he had promised to return Mexico kind of to the level and the standing that the country rightfully thought it belonged in, and that there was the hope that these types of, my words, no one else's, shenanigans were going to come to an end. That really becomes kind of a big letdown.
Well, and instead,
that things aren't changing.
Just the opposite.
And becoming worse.
Just the opposite occurred. I mean, one of the reporters who came up with a story about a sweetheart deal for a house that the president's wife had been given or had built for her, instead of, you know, acknowledging that this kind of corruption needed to be rooted out, they went after this reporter, got her fired, and she was one of the people that they tried to infect her phone. She apparently was smart enough to see that it was a trick, but some other folks didn't.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's the fact that this is out there and they're able to use this to go after people who are basically acting as a check on government is really concerning. And like I said, in my reading of this, mm-hmm. I keep going like, do we have this going on in our country? Because mm-hmm. I would not be surprised if our country had access to this kind of software and was using it for various reasons. I'm hoping that they would stick to just using it for terrorism suspects and criminal suspects and aren't using it on law-abiding citizens.
Okay, well, production halted last week on the ABC reality show The Bachelor in Paradise. That was actually going on in Mexico. This came after scandal broke regarding a possible sexual assault of one of the contestants by another contestant, an assault that Warner Brothers investigations have determined did not happen. So the video that shows, because when you're producing a reality show, there's a lot of video shows that the act was consensual, but at the same time, this is after both of the parties have been named, after every clickbaity type site you can think about has dragged this man's name through the mud. There are a lot of problems here.
There are so many layers to this story, and just because Warner Brothers, owned by Time Warner, which owns CNN and a lot of news organizations, claims that their investigation showed that it was consensual, doesn't mean it was consensual. And if you know or have read anything about the way reality television shows work behind the scenes,
or watched Unreal on Lifetime,
exactly, you can imagine that some of the things that were claimed did occur. The problem is everybody has a vested interest in telling a different story, including the contestants who claimed that they were wrong. So we have no idea what really happened, and the videotape is apparently not going to be released. And so unless some civil suit or some law enforcement person gets in there and digs, we'll probably never really know what happened.
Well, I mean, as you have told us time and time again, being the reality
you are our reality guy on
this show, that even though it says it's reality, it is also scripted. I mean, one of the things that keeps coming out is that this show's producers were trying to get these two together, and this was one way in which they were trying to make that happen, and it didn't turn out the way that they necessarily expected. That's one of the narratives that's been floating around. So, you know, whenever I think about reality, when someone says a reality show, I go back to your definition, which is reality in many ways is just as scripted as a dramatic show or anything else that's on.
Don't be too surprised if this turns out to be just a promotional campaign by ABC to get people to watch The Bachelor in Paradise.
Okay, and if it is, shouldn't we be, and by we I mean the journalism world, be embarrassed that we spent how many weeks reporting on it as though it was news?
Well, my whole point with that is, why are you doing that? I mean, I know that the summer months are slow, but there's a lot of other important things going on out there than this. And even if you didn't want to cover the important news, there are other light news things that are going on in the world that you could go to instead of this. But this is all about clickbait. This is going to get people's attention.
Well, Ernest, remember before we taped the show last week, I told you I was worried that we would end up recording in the afternoon and the Cosby jury would come back before the show could air. Well, that didn't happen. It was Saturday morning before the judge finally accepted the jury was hopelessly deadlocked and declared a mistrial. Cable news networks, they latched onto this story pretty hard. Again, it was a Saturday morning without much else going on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised that this was a mistrial. I mean, you could just see it coming. You had, they said the prosecutor wasn't as forceful, didn't present as much information as they could. You had Cosby's team that was really going after the witnesses. You had a jury that was pretty mixed. But when you think about it, you have Bill Cosby, who's a star. You got age involved, you got race involved, you've got gender
celebrity
involved, you got celebrity involved. I mean, this was a classic setup for a mistrial, and that's what happened. So the verdict doesn't surprise me at all.
I'm not too surprised either. I mean, it was basically he said, she said.
Yeah.
There was no physical evidence. There were no other witnesses. It happened a long time ago.
Right.
So who knows? It certainly does say, once again, this is just one more example, why would a woman ever file a charge of sexual assault, especially against somebody as famous as Bill Cosby, because this is what's going to happen to
right,
you.
Right. I mean, and it's sad that we're at this point, but I think that even the legal experts that they tried it out after it was over with were basically saying that they weren't surprised by this.
So the coverage being as aggressive as it was Saturday morning, you think that might have been one of the things that got the prosecutor to commit to retrying so quickly?
I don't know. I mean, he ran for election saying he was going to try this case.
Okay.
And so that kind of makes sense. There is an interesting media angle to it, though, if you ask me. And that's this request now by several news organizations to get the names of the jurors.
The
judge is supposed to decide sometime today as we're taping this whether to allow that. And the problem, of course, is that we in the media want to know, why did this happen? Was there one holdout? What were the arguments? But the judge and the prosecutor have told the jurors, don't talk, because we're going to have another trial, and if we have another trial, don't taint the jury pool. So you've got some competing interests there.
Okay, two more things I want to try to get to before we're out of time today. It's a new day at Fox News, sort of. After 21 years, the cable network has dropped its fair and balanced motto. It's hard to think of Fox as anything but fair and balanced. Does this actually prevent them, if that's not their branding anymore, from having to be balanced or fair in their approach?
Well, you know, they would say that they were fair and balanced in a certain way, and you would have others that would say they were nowhere near fair and balanced.
Yeah.
You have some at Fox that were claiming that they stopped doing this a long time ago, that they've just made the decision to make it public now, that sort of thing. But you still have some of their anchors, some of their stars, especially in the night,
the primetime
guys, people are still using, they throw Fair and Balanced out there every now and then just to because it connects to Roger Ailes, which is where this all started, and Fox wants to move away from the Ailes era.
You can believe, I think, that the Murdoch brothers really do want to move this news channel away from its confrontational conservative edge. They also apparently have gotten rid of We Report, You Decide, for what's the new one that they're saying now? Most watched, most trusted. Yeah. That's a lot more milquetoast than those other two. And maybe they are trying to move away from Ailes. Maybe they are trying to broaden their appeal.
I don't know. I hear most watched, most trusted, and I think that's something that could be very easily quantified, too, and can be proven right or wrong. Okay, last thing before we run out of time today. I want to bring up something that might be considered a little inside baseball, but something, again, that I find troublesome nonetheless. Non-compete clauses in professional contracts. They're not all that common. An unemployment contract that prevents someone from going to work for a competitor for a certain amount of time after leaving a job. Usually it's 6 months or a year, but there's a report that Now This, an online social video newsroom, has its new employees signing a contract that prevents them from working for close to a dozen different competitors for 2 years. I get the idea of not wanting to train your competition, but 2 years in digital journalism, that's career murder.
In any job, to say I'm not going to take a position in a similar industry for 2 years or even a year seems like an awful lot to ask. I mean, it's putting the brakes on somebody's career. It's driving down wages. It's driving down competition. So from that standpoint, I just say it's a bad idea. And especially when it's applied to rank and file employees. Sure, your biggest anchor, your celebrity journalist, your top executive, you don't want them taking trade secrets or their secret sauce to another company and plying their trade there. But for the rank and file employees, it doesn't really make sense to me.
Yeah, I have a problem with this, and I'm actually wondering whether or not this is even legal. I mean, to actually tell someone that, you know, if you sign on with me, and I'm going to pay you $35,000, $40,000 a year, if you decide to leave, then you can't go and work for these companies for 2 years. I mean, you've got to be able to find an attorney, which you're going to have a problem with 41, but still, you got to be able to find an attorney that's going to be able to shoot holes all through that kind of contract.
See, and my fear, too, is that so many of these positions, when you talk about the rank and file, they're going to young people who don't have a whole lot of professional experience, who aren't perhaps savvy enough to know to have somebody read it. They're so excited to be offered a job, they're going to take it without understanding or thinking it'll be okay later.
And it might not be okay. I mean, yes, these things are enforced on a pretty haphazard basis, but there was an example on the Links blog you had of a reporter who went from one business publication to another and got fired because of this non-compete clause. She'd have had to pay an attorney tens of thousands of dollars to make her case, and until the New York Attorney General stepped in and said these things are illegal, you know, a lot of other people were faced with the same thing. So it's not as simple as saying, oh, don't worry, they won't enforce it.
But I mean, this also goes back to the fact that we, and I say we, those of us who are in education, have to educate our students once they're going out there that you need to make sure you understand everything that's in the agreement that you're going to sign.
Okay. Well, that music pretty much means we're out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. That's under the Programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next time, and more. We're going to be taking a few weeks off, but we'll be back with you on July 12th for a brand new edition of Views of the News. Before we go, our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Kyle Felling for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original audio.